Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're painstakingly going through the Constitutional Convention. And we're doing this so that you can kind of watch how things start forming. And as a matter of fact, they haven't really gotten anything other than the basic framework. They're trying to decide on the basic framework of the government before they really start hashing out the powers and, you know, creating the real form, or I should say the substance of the government. And that being said, we're already, let me see here, we're probably, I'd say maybe 1/6 the way through as far as content goes. In other words, we're basically on page 80 of almost 500 pages. And so when we look at the days that we have, they've already almost spent a month out of the four. So just to help you understand that they've been kind of, I'll just say, hamstrung in dealing with all of this formalizing, what are we going to decide to do? And so this is the last pitch, the last desperate pitch of people putting in their own agenda to hopefully either sideline or influence the direction. Now, in some ways, because we were kind of talking about this with Hamilton, in some ways, you know, there are these two sayings that the first impression is the lasting impression. And the last impression is the, and there's a word for it, but the last impression can be the dominating impression. And what I mean by that is, you know, when we're being presented with ideas, sometimes we lose the, you know, the focus and the context when we get, because the final, this last idea that's being presented by Hamilton is just, it's fresh in your mind. He's already heard all of the other arguments. In other words, now that I've heard you and what you've put on the table, I am coming to the table addressing and assaulting what you put on the table. So it's kind of too late for you to change your plan. And my plan has been tweaked and adjusted to make it seem superior to yours. And so this is why the person that gives the last pitch usually has the opportunity of having the dominating pitch, where that pitch, you know, is already been tweaked and fine-tuned to dispel or attack the other pitches. And fundamentally, as Hamilton pointed out, there were really just two primary pitches, even though there were these other suggestions and or, you know, primarily they were just suggestions. The two primary pitches was the Virginia plan and the New Jersey plan. Now, there was Connecticut and the Roger Sherman plan. And for the most part, we already kind of saw that there was this lent, or I should say there was this propensity of people kind of preferring the compromise of this idea of the Senate being the state sovereignty representation and the House being for the people based on population, so forth, per the states. So anyway, let me kind of dive forward into this. The whole point, though, the reason why we're going through all of this is so that you can start really appreciating, and as it was said in our previous episode, that these men were, you know, this was like once in a lifetime or once throughout the annals of history where men had been so prepared in the theories of government with the historical data and, you know, the understanding of the pittings and the downfalls, where there never really had been a point in time, like I said, other than maybe the Magna Carta, where men actually were trying to create checks and balances, you know, and trying to frame a government, in a tranquil setting to where they could really put their full thoughts on this. I have said that the Articles of Confederation were done during wartime. There was always the looking over your shoulder, what was going on, the responding to that, and sometimes what was going on in the war leaked itself into the Articles of Confederation. The point is this, is that this truly was a moment, and the thing that really set this off, because I think this is the key that I said last episode, the thing that really sets this off or sets this above every other point in time when a government was instituted out of men, not through theocracies, that these men of different, you know, I'll call them doctrinal Christians, these men came together on knees praying and asking that they may be able to unite in creating a great government with his blessing in his hand. And so that right there, to me, is no doubt the doors and, you know, the heavens being open. I should say the doors and windows of these men were opening these doors and windows so that the heavens could actually come in and inspire and help move them. Where when Hamilton stood up, I think Hamilton and his whole point that we kind of got to, and now I want to get Sean in here because I think Sean might have a go back. I want to give him the opportunity because we ran out of time. We ran out of time as I kind of laid this out that clearly, the substance of everything that Hamilton was really pitching was all towards a monarchical executive, a lifetime executive, and hereditary type of executive, and so forth. So anyway, Sean, was there anything that you read yesterday or in the last episode that, you know, sets it apart or, you know, things you wanted to comment on and things that I may have said that you say, well, I have a bone of contention with you or whatever, anything?
No bones here, sir.
Okay. Awesome. So no go-backs. All right.
No, sir.
So now he's basically laying out kind of like these, instead of creating resolutions, resolved, he's basically laying it out like, this is what we're going to do. One, boom, and two, boom, and three, boom, and so forth and so on. And so, in other words, he's taking this vent that, hey, you know, why not? I've got a blank check. I'm in front of everybody. I'm going to let everybody basically, you know, I'm going to feed them exactly how this needs to be done and make it easy for them just to accept that. Because sometimes that is a very successful, I would say, sales pitch. You just do everything for them. They look at it and go, wow, this is a good job. Let's just take this. But with these men and these separate interests and so forth, I didn't think that he had any chance at all in swaying them one way or the other. So welcome back Tammy as well, because folks, we got Tammy back. And so we are on again, we're at that point where he's going through this framework or creating the framework for the government on page 80. And so, Tammy, you with us? And so, she probably is. Yeah, okay, there she is. So, since you've been gone, maybe you can start us off with his framework of the government. Because Madison put it to this way. He read his sketch, or, you know, the sketching of the government, in the following words, to wit, and then one. So go ahead and go with one and two, and then we'll have Sean read three and four. And then there's a break with the, so go ahead, why don't you read one, two, and three, and then Sean can read four and five, and then we can discuss anything as well in between now and then. But anyway, let's go ahead with one, two, and three. Thanks.
The supreme legislative power of the United States of America to be vested in two different bodies of men, the one to be called the Assembly, the other the Senate, who together shall form the legislature of the United States with power to pass all laws whatsoever subject to the negative hereafter mentioned. the assembly to consist of persons elected by the people to serve for 3 years. Then it says electors for three. The Senate to consist of persons elected to serve during good behavior, their election to be made by electors chosen for that purpose by the people. In order to this, the states to be divided into election districts. On the death, removal, or resignation of any senator, his place to be filled out of the district from which he came.
Okay, so go ahead, Sean, and pick up four. Are there any questions on kind of what you read?
No, sir.
Okay.
Number four.
All right.
The Supreme...
Go ahead.
The supreme executive authority of the United States to be vested in a governor to be elected to serve during good behavior, the election to be made by electors chosen by the people in the election districts aforesaid. The authorities and functions of the executive to be as follows: to have a negative on all laws about to be passed and the execution of all laws passed, to have the direction of war when authorized or begun, to have with the advice and approbation of the Senate the power of making all treaties, to have the sole appointment of the heads or chief officers of departments of finance, war, and foreign affairs, to have the nomination of all other officers, ambassadors of foreign nations included, subject to the approbation or rejection of the Senate, to have the power of pardoning all offenses except treason, which he shall not pardon without the approbation of the Senate.
Okay, so I'm not sure if either of you noticed, but there's this differentiation between an elector with a little e and the choosing made by electors. So in other words, they're using the exact same word here, but they're referring to two different bodies of people. The little e electors chosen by the for that purpose by the people. In other words, they're talking about their election being made by electors. And so they're using this little e, and I'm not sure if the Senate, if he's actually saying that the Senate is going to be chosen by the same capital E electors, because in the next, in four, where Sean read, that the election be made by electors chosen by the people. So he used the exact same framing, but for some reason there's a capitalization difference. Now, to me, these electors that we know to create the Electoral College were to be chosen by the people. And in the Constitution, they're actually identified as a four-year term. So one of the things, and I'm just going to throw this out here, because we have electors, and because we actually have these candidates and so forth for the period of a four-year election term, would it make sense if you actually still had the Electoral College? Once the Electoral College was formed in the general election, and let's say the president died, and remember, keep in mind, folks, that the electors choose both the president and the vice president, right? They don't create a president who chooses his own vice president. The Constitution dictates that both seats would be chosen by the electors. They can choose to have a Democrat president and a Republican vice president or vice versa. They get to choose who does what, who goes into what seat. Therefore, I'm just throwing this out here, because I've always had this, you know, this sentiment that if the Electoral College is formed, it still exists until the next election, even though these electors have no other function than choosing the president and vice president. If a president dies, why wouldn't they go back to that Electoral College and say, hey, the president's dead, who now will you choose to be president and vice president? In other words, maintaining the selection by these people chosen by the people. Does that make sense?
Then what would be the purpose of the vice president?
Well, so the vice president has these functions. Now, they don't go through those, but I think the president creates that. And I think I get it that the vice president would be that second person. But again, you know, and I think I even mentioned to Tammy that if we got away from the president, maybe a board of directors would be better. You know, in other words, a five-person, you know, team of executives where one is chosen as the president, and then these other four would be kind of being able to work and being able to be delegated to, instead of necessarily having, you know, certain positions, i.e., a Secretary of State, Secretary, that would actually be chosen by the electors, because these guys would then be the executive, help me out here, these executive appointments over these different departments, these functions. Because
I think you need one executive, especially now in the times we live in, because things happen so fast. You need somebody that can make a decision.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that you wouldn't have a single executive that would be actually the guy that would make the call. In other words, it would be his responsibility to do that. The question is, if the executive dies under the existing system, should the Electoral College, because it's still formed, should the Electoral College, based on the premise, be the better way of doing it? I know they created a vice president as that fall gap. And I do know that back in their days, reforming the Electoral College and being able to communicate, because communication sucked. If they lived in today's time, would they have actually maintained a tether to the Electoral College to say, you know, don't go away, folks, we may need you during this four-year, you know, opportunity? And if an elector would die during that 4 years, they would go back to the people of the vicinage, that they would either have to choose a new elector or whatever that process would be via state and so forth, or governor appointment. But my point is this, is that when we kind of look at the importance of the executive and we look at the importance of trying to maintain, you know, this idea of these separate functions, because some states allow their attorney general, i.e. Wyoming, the attorney general is appointed by the governor, kind of like the president appointing the attorney general. I'm not necessarily, you know, a fan of either way. I believe that there are two good competing ways, and I think there's arguments, and I'm just throwing it out there that the electors could actually decide what would be best. Do you want to have, you know, an agenda driven by a single demagogue where, you know, you're going to have him, you know, pack all his executive seats with people that are going to do his bidding? Or do you want to create a level of resistance because maybe the times warrant that? If you look at the Civil War, well, there was a reason why Andrew Johnson was picked by the Electoral College to be the vice president, because he was really a Democrat. He was a Southern Democrat. He was in the Republican Party, but I'm telling you, he was a Southern Democrat. So, all that being said, I'm just throwing out these ideas, but I digress. Here Hamilton is talking about electors chosen by the people, where they're going to actually choose the Senate. These electors are also going to choose the president. This is the guardian of, you know, protecting us from a mob rule or a direct democracy, using electors. So, anyway, Tammy, why don't you go ahead and pick up 5 and 6 and 7, and then Sean, why don't you go ahead and pick up 8, 9, and 10 when she's done? Go ahead, Tammy.
On the death, resignation, or removal of the governor, his authorities to be exercised by the president of the Senate till a successor be appointed. The Senate to have the sole power of declaring war, the power of advising and approving all treaties, the power of approving or rejecting all appointments of officers, except the heads or chiefs of the departments of finance, war, and foreign affairs. Then number 7, the supreme judicial authority to be vested in judges to hold their offices during good behavior with adequate and permanent salaries. This court to have original jurisdiction in all causes of capture, and an appellative jurisdiction in all causes in which the revenues of the general government or the citizens of foreign nations are concerned.
Okay. Go ahead, Sean, with 8, 9, and 10.
Number 8, the legislature of the United States to have power to institute courts in each state for the determination of all matters of general concern. The governor, number 9, the governors, senators, and all officers of the United States to be liable to impeachment for mal and corrupt conduct, and upon conviction to be removed from office and disqualified for holding any place of trust or profit. All impeachments to be tried by a court to consist of the chief or judge of the superior court of law of each state, provided such judge shall hold his place during good behavior and have a permanent salary. Number 10, all laws of the particular states contrary to the Constitution or laws of the United States to be utterly void, and the better to prevent such laws being passed, the governor or president of each state shall be appointed by the general government and shall have a negative upon the laws about to be passed in the state of which he is governor or president. Number 11.
Let's have Tammy do that one. Naval. Hey, Sean, let's let Tammy wrap this up. So, okay, so Tammy, why don't you go ahead and kind of wrap up the last 11 and the final paragraph and so forth. But before we do that, is there anything out of what Tammy read before and what you just read, Sean, that kind of jumps out? So to me, there's a few things that kind of jump out. One, he kind of talks about, you know, this very limited view of the courts here. I mean, when you really look at what the courts were pitched in the Constitution and what he was looking at, I mean, it was like there was, you know, he was completely oblivious to the role that the courts would be taking or needed to take or what have you. I mean, shoot, that they would have the jurisdiction over causes of capture and appellate jurisdiction over revenue. I mean, what about admiralty law? What about, you know, all these other things? So, and I don't know if that was just a sleight of hand where he was just seeming like he wasn't putting too much focus on it just to keep people from worrying about containing or, you know, tying down the judiciary. Anyway, but the legislative, and he's talking about having the appointments of governors by the Senate, or I think by the United States shall institute the courts around here. The governors and officers will be liable to impeachment, but he talks about how are they going to be put in. I could have swore that they would be appointed by the Senate. Is that not what you read?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, in other words, the states would then have a ruler that has been put in, kind of like what King George did to the colonies by removing the chosen governors of the people and or legislature of the people, and the king put in his own governors. And so I just don't think the people would like that. But anyway, any comments on any of these things that were brought up? Okay. So
not right now.
Okay. So Tammy, let's go ahead and have you kind of wrap this up to where the committee rose and adjourned. So let's go ahead and find those three little paragraphs. Thank you.
Okay. Number 11, no state to have any forces, land, or naval, and the militia of all the states to be under the sole exclusive direction of the United States, the officers of which to be appointed and commissioned by them. On these several articles, he entered into explanatory observations corresponding with the principles of his introductory reasoning. The committee rose and the House adjourned.
Okay, so what they don't say is Hamilton got on his horse and rode into the sunset. Because as I look at, because I see Lansing kind of pipes in a little bit later, and I know Hamilton comes back the next day and makes a comment. But when I, and actually as I go through, I guess on the 21st he was still there. Because the nice thing is we have this navigation pane, if you're using it, folks, and you can find out when Hamilton was still kind of there defending his position and when he finally said, okay, I've got to go because there's meddling to do up in New York, and he basically leaves and is no longer making any contributions. There's nobody there from New York at all. But anyway, with that, we've got a break. We'll be right back after this one promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so they adjourned the day before, and now the following day, on Tuesday the 19th, they all of a sudden decided, hey, let's get back to where we were before that rude interruption of Mr. Hamilton. And I don't think that it was necessarily that. I mean, but that's exactly what they did. They literally put back onto the focus of the committee the propositions of Mr. Patterson. Mr. Patterson, Mr. P, was the one that was presenting the New Jersey plan. So in other words, that horse hadn't finished its ride. And so they needed to, you know, get that horse all the way through its ride before they could, you know, either put it back in the stall and kill it or whatever, what they were going to do. And knowing that they were going to really reject this. But I think there were some ideas and debates that helped influence the Virginia plan, or I should say, what became the compromise, the Connecticut compromise of merging in the legislative, in Congress, this divided control over very specific roles where the Senate would protect these things and the House would protect these things. And so anyway, with that, Mr. Patterson's plan was then before the committee, so I'm just kind of reading that. So at this point, now we've got this oration from Mr. Madison, and this is a long one. And so this is just like Hamilton, if you really go through this, this is that long. So what we want to do is we want to try to break this up with equitable, you know, places. So what we want to try to do and maintain ideas, thoughts, punctuations, and so forth. So at this point, why don't you, Sean, let's try to read all the way through until we get to, let me just see here, because this is almost a whole page. Let's try to cut this in half. And what I'll do is I'll just, I see it, if the breach of any article, let me see here. This is where he talks about these breaches of the Articles of the Compact. And so when we get to that, we'll take a break and dive into these, and then we'll shift over to, to Tammy. And then, you know, we'll find another point to break. But obviously, so Madison is finally standing up for the first time and really throwing out, you know, the support of the direction of the, maybe he's supporting, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily supporting. I think he's supporting all the good ideas and how to move forward. But anyway, let's go ahead and start it off, Sean, with Mr. Madison's stress. Go ahead.
Much stress had been laid by some gentlemen on the want of power in the convention to propose any other than a federal plan. To what had been answered by others, he would only add that neither of the characteristics attached to a federal plan would support this objection. One characteristic was that in a federal government, the power is exercised not on the people individually, but on the people collectively, on the states. Yet in some instances, as in piracies, captures, and etc., the existing Confederacy, and in many instances, the amendments to it proposed by Mr. Patterson, must operate immediately on individuals. The other characteristic was that a federal government derived its appointments not immediately from the people, but from the states which they respectively composed. Here, too, were facts on the other side. In two of the states, Connecticut and Rhode Island, the delegates to Congress were chosen not by the legislators, but by the people at large, and the plan of Mr. Patterson intended no change in this particular. It had been alleged by Mr. Patterson that the Confederation, having been formed by unanimous consent, could be dissolved by unanimous consent only. Does this doctrine result from the nature of compacts? Does it arise from any particular stipulation in the Articles of Confederation? If we consider the Federal Union as analogous to the fundamental compact by which individuals compose one society, and which must, in its theoretic origin at least, have been the unanimous act of the component members, it cannot be said that no dissolution of the compact can be effected without unanimous consent. A breach of the fundamental principles of the compact by a part of the society would certainly absolve the other part from their obligations to it. If the breach of any article by any of the parties does not set the others at liberty, it is because the contrary is implied in the compact itself, and particularly by that law of it, which gives an indefinite authority to the majority to bind the whole in all cases. This latter circumstance shows that we are not to consider the Federal Union as an analogous to the social compact of individuals. For if it were so, a majority would have a right to bind the rest, and even to form a new constitution for the whole, which the gentleman from New Jersey would be among the last to admit. If we consider the Federal Union as analogous not to the social compacts among individual men, but the conventions among individual states, what is the doctrine resulting from these conventions? Clearly, according to the expositors of the law of nations, that a breach of any one article by any one party leaves all the other parties at liberty to consider the whole convention as dissolved, unless they choose, to compel the delinquent party to repair the breach. In some treaties, indeed, it is expressly stipulated that a violation of particular articles shall not have this consequence, and even that particular articles shall remain in force during war, which in general is understood to dissolve all subsisting treaties. But are there any exceptions of this sort to the Articles of Confederation? So far from it that there is not even an express stipulation that force shall be used to compel an offending member of the Union to discharge its duty. He observed that the violations of the federal articles had been numerous and notorious. Among the most notorious was an act of New Jersey herself, by which she expressly refused to comply with the constitutional requisition of Congress and yielded no farther to the expostulations of their deputies than barely to rescind her vote of refusal without passing any positive act of compliance. He did not wish to draw any rigid inferences from these observations. He thought it proper, however, that the true nature of the existing Confederacy should be investigated, and he was not anxious to strengthen the foundation on which it now stands. Proceeding to consideration of Mr. Patterson's plan, he stated the object of a proper plan to be twofold. One, to preserve the Union. Two, to provide a government that will remedy the evils felt by the states, both in their united and individual capacities. Examine Mr. Patterson's plan and say whether it promises satisfaction in these respects.
Okay, so obviously this whole section really dealt with an idea that I wanted to maintain, and so that's why we didn't break it, or I didn't call to say, hey, because he starts talking about the compact. He literally is opening up the door of what exactly are we doing here, and what exactly is the method for us to get out from underneath this.
are we all doomed by the Articles of Confederation that because it requires unanimity to do anything that nobody can leave? But then he brings in this whole concept of contract law, that if there be a breach of one article is a breach of the entire compact, and that any point in time, at any point in time, an individual party can break away, the parties can form a tribunal, so let me go to you, Sean, and then I'm going to ask you, Tammy. We've read a couple of times, you and I, the Virginia resolutions, as well as Madison's notes on the resolution, where he talks about this fundamental principle of contract law, that when there is a breach, it actually relieves the parties to it if they feel that the breach is both willful and material, that, you know, they have a right to leave. And if the parties to it choose to say, hey, hold on here, because the breach isn't among the states themselves, the breach is the federal government, then the parties themselves have the obligation and or can, if they believe that the union and the compact is worth saving, they can force that party, or I should say not the party, but the creature created by the compact, i.e. the federal government, they can hold it accountable and force it into compliance. Now, have we not, this is kind of a front-end view, right, of what we've read in those documents regarding the, I call it Republic Review, but in those documents of the Virginia resolutions and so forth, correct?
Correct, sir.
Okay, so... Yep. So this is very consistent. I mean, it's not like he's changed anything regarding these principles that he's repeated over and over again. And so his point is that when we're looking at this plan, we actually have a right to actually and fundamentally change this plan. Because bottom line, and he doesn't get into the violations. I think for the most part, I believe going through the history of the amendments, they were able to find, and I think earlier in the convention, some of the problems were already brought up between the species of currency or the paper money from the states, you know, paying the debt, treaties, all of these different things were being brought up that the parties themselves were going, you know, riding roughshod over the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation were just failing. So what do they do? And this is why I think he went into this diatribe. What are we going to do? Can we even fix this? And I believe that the logical argument is that they can't, that they need to completely reframe it, because the death nail is what, Tammy? What is the death nail that has basically nailed all of the states down into becoming incapable of moving forward? Okay, the death nail to me is the unanimity. In other words, you can't change anything without everybody agreeing. So the whole point is, and this goes down to why the commission had to meet, why these delegates had to meet, and why the commission basically needed to be open-ended so that they could actually present a plan that would get rid of the death nail. They knew that if the death nail continued, in other words, the unanimity, everybody had to buy into it. They were doomed. You might as well just say, okay, it's over. There's no hope for the union. We got to disband it and get rid of that thing. And then let's talk maybe in a month or two and see how everything's going. Because for the most part, I think people would start seeing ships on the horizon that may be, you know, donning French and British and Spaniard, you know, flags because, hey, we're ripe for the picking now that we failed. If you give me the latitude, I believe that the death knell, in a metaphoric sense, is the unanimity. And anybody that said that they couldn't change that basically said that you, because you made this and because you bought into this, you had to die first. And I'm saying this because there are people in the, you know, the pro-convention, anti-conventionite, conventionite, anti-conventionite arguments that go on every year in the state legislatures. We got to have a convention. No, you can't have a convention. If, you know, the first convention was a runaway, they deliberately undermined it by getting rid of the unanimity. Well, hold on here. The whole point was they had to get rid of the unanimity or the union would have died. That's the whole point. So I consider that a death nail. And I think all of these men realized that and knew that. So what, anything you, either of you want to lead or lend to, you know, how profound this was, that he actually brought this up, you know, towards the very beginning, that, hey, we're moving forward with a new compact. And this compact is written by us, the states, and we're going to ratify this. And we're going to make these major changes so that we can survive as a union without the death nail being over our head and giving the government the energy it needs and so forth. I mean, he's not saying that, but, you know, this is all leading to why they had to move forward. And in understanding this in contract law sense, I believe the only latitude, the only thing they could do was to present a new plan. They had to.
Right.
Okay.
It's interesting that Hamilton didn't bring up any of that, because under his plan, they would have unanimity because they would eliminate all the power to states by selecting their governors. So whoever was in charge and their machinations to get these people on the same page, it wasn't a problem with unanimity.
Yes.
When you have 13 sovereign states that have to agree on something, then you have a whole different issue.
Right. And so actually the machinations would come from where? If you really look at what Hamilton was basically doing, Hamilton was taking away...
Come from the Senate.
Well, but no. Think about the existing colonies or states. You'd actually have three or four states that would literally form control over the national government. So in other words, the areas of Virginia, the areas of Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and New York, and then you got the Carolinas too. I mean, the Carolinas, you could kind of join together along with maybe Georgia as one voter block, because the states, the boundaries get wiped out. In essence, you still have these governors. And actually, thinking about that, it provides a divide and conquer opportunity by maintaining the boundaries. But I still look at Virginia being the most populated state, probably being the taking point on the majority of the seats, because the seats in the Senate are going to be elected by the people, and that's going to be based on population. And so how many, you'd actually have to start joining. And technically, let's look at it this way. Delaware and Maryland are right next to Virginia. If they're in the same legislative swath, then they're going to be competing for a representative that would possibly, overviewed in the Senate by, Virginia voters, if that makes sense, as we start looking at how county lines, or now in this essence, state lines, because he didn't get into the details of his plan, but how is the Senate to be chosen? By states? By population? And so when you look at 50,000, and what would that population be? I guess they could go down to the common denominator being the smallest state, that population, it can't be lower than that, but it can't exceed, or let's say it can't exceed that, then, okay, Delaware will at least have one senator. But what about Maryland? Maryland, they won't have enough for two. So it would really stack the Senate with these more populated states, because it would be Democratic in form by population. and not by the sovereignty, wiping out the state sovereignty altogether. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I just see that the way everything's going to be going, that these large populated states, because they'll have more votes to actually start appointing their own governors or those governors who would be favorable to, you know, the cabal that's forming now in the Senate. Because that's what I think would happen. And so, and who was it that was talking about the checks and balances? Was it Hamilton that was talking about checks and balances or the importance of it? I don't want to think that, but anyway, I think it was maybe somebody before Hamilton. But nevertheless, Tammy, let's go ahead and pick up where Hamilton or Madison kind of left off. And he talks about one, two, because up above, right before Sean finished reading, he said that there'd be twofold of this plan, Mr. Patterson's plan. You know, one being to preserve the Union, and two, to provide a government that will remedy the evils felt by the states, both in their united and individual capacities. So let's examine Mr. P's plan, or Mr. Patterson's plan. And so one, and then two, he kind of goes through them that way. And so why don't you go ahead and read one and two, and then we'll have Sean pick up three. Go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. To prevent those violations of law, of nations, and of treaties, which if not prevented, must involve us in the calamities of foreign wars, the tendency of the states to these violations has been manifested in sundry instances. The files of Congress contain complaints already from almost every nation with which treaties have been formed. Hitherto indulgence has been shown to us. This cannot be the permanent disposition of foreign nations. Rupture with other powers is among the greatest of national calamities. It ought therefore to be effectually provided that no part of a nation shall have it in its power to bring them on the whole. The existing Confederacy does not sufficiently provide against this evil. The proposed amendment to it does not supply the omission. It leaves the will of the states as uncontrolled as ever. Number two, will it prevent encroachments on the federal authority? A tendency to such encroachments has been sufficiently exemplified among ourselves as well, in every other confederated republic, antient and modern. By the federal articles, transactions with the Indians appertain to Congress, yet in several instances the states have entered into treaties and wars with them. In like manner, no two or more states can form among themselves any treaties, etc., without the consent of Congress. Yet Virginia and Maryland, in one instance, Pennsylvania and New Jersey in another, have entered into compacts without previous application or subsequent apology. No state, again, can of right raise troops in time of peace without the like consent. Of all cases in the League, this seems to require the most scrupulous observance. Has not Massachusetts, notwithstanding the most powerful member of the Union, already raised a body of troops? Is she not now augmenting them without having even deigned to apprise Congress of her intention? In fine, have we not seen the public lands dealt out to Connecticut to bribe her acquiescence in the decree constitutionally awarded against her claim on the territory of Pennsylvania? For no other possible motive can account for the policy of Congress in that measure. If we recur to the examples of other confederacies, we shall find in all of them the same tendency of the parts to encroach on the authority of the whole. He then reviewed the Amphictyonic and ancient confederacies among the ancients and the Helvetic, Germanic, and Belgic among the moderns, tracing their analogy to the U.S., to the United States and the Constitution, and the extent of their federal authorities and the tendency of the particular members to usurp on these authorities and to bring confusion and ruin on the whole. He observed that the plan of Mr. Patterson, besides omitting a control over the states as a general defense of the federal prerogatives, was particularly defective in two of its provisions. One, its ratification was not to be by the people at large, but by the legislatures. They could not, therefore, render the acts of Congress in pursuance of their powers, even legally paramount to the acts of the states. Two, it gave the federal tribunal an appellate jurisdiction only, even in the criminal cases enumerated. The necessity of any such provision supposed a danger undue acquittals in the state tribunals. Of what avail could any appellate tribunal be after an acquittal? Besides, in most, if not all, of the states, the executives have, by their respective constitutions, the right of pardoning.
Right of pardoning. Yeah.
The right of pardoning. How could this be taken from them by a legislative ratification only?
Okay, so when we look at what he was going through in these 2 points regarding Mr. Patterson's plan, I think he was kind of identifying how, one, the states were already complicit in violating the compact in one specific, you know, arena of creating compacts amongst themselves. He also starts going down into this history of, you know, going through the Greek and the Germanic histories of republics and so forth. So anything that jumps out for you, Sean, or you, Tammy, that you go, wow, you know, this is interesting. Because he's even pointing out how Massachusetts was already creating a very strong militia. This kind of lends to why, when we look at Massachusetts ratification, they basically said they don't need the Union now that we have this militia. So,
interesting.
So again, I think he's basically pointing out that if we continue down the path that we're going, then the states may be able to maintain their own sovereignty, but the general government will not ever be able to function in supporting the Union at all, because the states are going to continue to take advantage, of their positions. You know, if you look, I think he mentioned how Maryland and Virginia kind of created a compact amongst themselves. And I think it was, Pennsylvania and somebody else. But so the point is that the states are going to constantly be working for their own behalf at the expense of the Union. So, Sean, let's go ahead and pick up 3 and 4.
Time, sir.
Oh, you're right. We are out of time. Wow. I get engrossed in this stuff. If either of you two, realize you wanted to have, a go back or what have you, because we just don't have enough time, then obviously it's availed to you. So that when we meet next, we can actually have that time to go through these things. But Madison is really, I think, he's helping sell the point of how they have to move forward and away from the articles, or make these significant changes to get rid of the death knell and all of these other problems. And the best way to do that is to actually frame this new government and changing the government and so forth. So anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.